And we are back here on Freedom Now, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, kpfk.org on the web. As promised, I'm joined on the line by our in-house historian, author, and revolutionary researcher, Dr. Gerald Horn, who is going to drop some wisdom on us, beginning first with some thoughts on the recent elections in South Africa. But first things first, how are you doing today, Dr. Horn?
I'm fine, and yourself?
I am cool, copacetic, and curious to hear your take on the May 8th election results coming out of the country. The African National Congress, or ANC, has maintained their political stronghold in the government, with Cyril Ramaphosa being reelected president. However, the party has begun to see their popularity decline, while the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, established in 2014, has seen theirs rise dramatically. The EFF has grown to 44 out of the country's total 400 parliament seats and has become the official opposition party in the Northwest, Limpopo, and Mpumalanga provinces. With a magnetic appeal on the youth in the country, the EFF and their leader Julius Malema certainly have celebrated this year's election results. So, Dr. Horn, what can you tell us about the political climate and shifts taking place in South Africa?
That's a very good question. And as you know, I've just published a book, White Supremacy Confronted, U.S. Imperialism and Anti-Communism versus the Liberation of Southern Africa from Rhodes to Mandela, where I try to present background for readers to understand what's transpired in South Africa since 1994. And more to the point that you raised, the reduction of the majority in parliament of the African National Congress, which has a lot to do not only with misfirings on their part and missteps on their part, but also with the overall political environment globally. That is to say, as I talk about in the book, one of the reasons why the ANC was able to oust the apartheid regime in the first instance in 1994 was not least because of assistance from the socialist camp. Recall the Cuban troops were the decisive military force on the battlefield of Southern Africa, not necessarily the ANC's armed wing. But surprise, surprise, with the freeing of Nelson Mandela in 1990, that was preceded by the rapid decomposition of the socialist camp. And so therefore the ANC has been weakened and hasn't been able to keep all of its campaign promises. Some have been with regard to certain provisions of water, certain provisions of higher education without fees, etc. But certainly, as your comment suggests, the rise of the Economic Freedom Fighters bespeaks a certain kind of alienation of the South African election with regard to the majority party. Keep in mind as well that a significant percentage of the electorate didn't turn out. However, the good news with regard to the election is that the Democratic Alliance, which is a kind of neo-apartheid party, its percentage of the vote also failed, although it still rules in the Cape Province, which of course it includes Cape Town, one of the major cities of South Africa itself. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward with the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters. Obviously, they don't have a majority in the parliament. Certainly, I think they're going to be pressing very hard on the question of land reform, but there hangs a tail because, as you know, when ZANU-PF across the border in Zimbabwe began pressing on land reform in the 1990s, the North Atlantic powers led by the United States slapped sanctions on the Zimbabwean economy, helping to drive the economy into the ditch, leading to internal unrest, which then led to a kind of palace coup a couple of years ago that led to the sacking of longtime, long-term leader Robert Mugabe. I dare say that given Mr. Trump's tweets, where he's already raised this false and bogus issue of so-called genocide against the European minority farmers,
right,
that if the government, pressed by the Economic Freedom Fighters, starts pressing hard on the question of land reform, which is one of the burning issues in that part of the world, it'll be very interesting to see what the reaction from Washington will be.
Right on. So, Can you expand a bit on this subject of land reform? Because I know that one of the major platforms of the Economic Freedom Fighters, President Julius Malema, was this notion of expropriation of land without compensation. So can you speak a little more on that and its reception?
Well, it's interesting. The concept of expropriation without compensation has become a real buzzword in South Africa, and I dare say a buzzword within the sub-region as a whole. But once again, it's not necessarily a buzzword amongst the European minority, which is backed up by all of world imperialism led by the United States of America. So that's the nub of the issue. That's the problem. That is to say that the Europeans may be a minority within South Africa itself, but they have a formidable big brother in Washington, D.C.
Right, right. And with that, the New York Times released an article this week that I'm sure made President Trump foam at the mouth. They reported that in this conflict over land reform, that Stephen Smith, a prominent white farmer of grapes in South Africa, was shot dead following a home invasion, or what some, including myself, may call a revolutionary coup. Now, we've already seen these white farmers begin forming militias in order to protect their farms from what they call native aggression. And President Ramaphosa has begun to take heat internationally for his support of land reform. Can you speak some more on this atmosphere in the country?
Well, what's interesting, on the one hand, we've had more farmers of European descent who have been attacked and killed in South Africa than in Zimbabwe. We just made reference to the fact that Zimbabwe has suffered grievously as a result of moving towards land reform and trying to take back land on behalf of the African majority. On the other hand, consider the numbers. That is to say that in Zimbabwe, there's probably the European population of no more than maybe 100, 125,000 out of an overall population of 12 to 13 million, whereas in South Africa, there's a European population of about 5 million out of a population of 50 to 55 million. So it stands to reason, given those numbers, that there would probably be more farmers of European descent who would be attacked and killed in South Africa than in Zimbabwe itself. But to repeat, I think that that whole sub-region is a powder keg. It's not sustainable for a majority of the African population to be in poverty and living in a society that has the most skewed economic maldistribution of wealth on planet Earth, and that these farmers would be well advised to try to negotiate some sort of settlement rather than digging in their heels and depending upon their support from Uncle Sam or Uncle Donald to bail them out.
All right, so those are the current happenings in the aftermath of the elections in South Africa. Our listeners, please stick around, and we'll be right back after this short musical interlude to talk further with Dr. Horn next about his newest book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. You are tuned in to Freedom Now on KPFK. Thank you. We are back with Dr. Gerald Horn, esteemed historian and author of the new book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. So, Dr. Horn, please give our listeners an introduction to your latest work of literary art.
It's a sweeping history of this music that's called jazz, J-A-Z-Z, that developed most likely in New Orleans post-U.S. Civil War, that is to say at the end of the 19th century, oftentimes with newly freed enslaved, formerly enslaved Africans, picking up instruments from military bands that had been in New Orleans and then were dispersed after the Civil War concluded. It's a music that depends upon mastery of different instruments, particularly piano, a horn, saxophone in particular, trumpet, of course, percussion, and bass in particular, although not exclusively. It's a music that, like much of Black American popular music, has its roots in West Africa, particularly in terms of the percussion, that is to say the drumming, but it's also a music that flows and grows out of the music we call the blues, which is this form of music that also comes out of the Deep South that expresses the pain, hopes, and sufferings of the Black American population. Now, this book traces the history of this music with an emphasis on how the musicians were seeking to organize to claim the wealth that they were producing, and also how various forces were seeking to prevent these mostly Black musicians from claiming the wealth that they were producing. One of the stories that I tell in this 500-page book in some ways is emblematic of the music. That is to say, in the 1920s in St. Louis, you had this cruel dilemma whereby the Ku Klux Klan forces were trying to prevent Black musicians from earning a living by playing at clubs, whereas the organized crime forces, the mafia-type forces, wanted these Black musicians to play so that they could exploit them shamelessly. And as it turns out, these two forces squared off, with the mafia coming out on top. But obviously, this is hard to call a victory for these Black American musicians, that they won the so-called right to be exploited by the mafia by playing in these clubs in St. Louis. Another emblematic story in this book is the story of Duke Ellington. You might know that this pianist, this composer, was born in Washington, D.C. I think it was the equally famed trumpeter, Miles Davis, who said that basically every musician should get down on their knees and thank Duke Ellington for his contribution and the way he shaped the music. But despite that, the fact of the matter is that Duke Ellington's manager, Irving Mills, put his name on many of Duke Ellington's compositions to the point where even today, though both have passed from the scene, the fact is that the descendants of Irving Mills are getting the royalties from some of the music that Duke Ellington composed, and the descendants of Duke Ellington do not receive those particular royalties. Mm-hmm. That is a kind of emblem of the music. I also talk about the transition of this music from a kind of dance music to a kind of listening music. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the authorities were very upset that this music had so-called crossover appeal, shall we say, mm-hmm. to use that euphemism that describes how non-Black audiences vibed with this music and resonated with this music. And so they were trying to prevent this kind of interracial dancing and mingling. And so there was a kind of clampdown on certain clubs that specialized in that kind of dance music, which then led to a kind music where people would just listen instead of dancing. I also tell the story about how a number of musicians, including Los Angeles' own Charles Mingus, who, along with the drummer and percussionist Max Roach, tried to develop their own record company, Debut Records, in the 1950s. But once again, it was very difficult for them to do so, given the overall white supremacy and Jim Crow in society. In fact, one of the sub-themes of this book is that organized crime has played a major role within this particular musical form, just like it's played a major role in U.S. cultural production generally.
Right.
I wrote a book some years ago about the role of organized crime in Hollywood, for example. But what's interesting is that whenever you had an attempt to establish and form the so-called black organized crime family, what happened is that their Italian-American and Jewish-American counterparts would use their clout within the police department, within the district attorney's office, to make sure that these black organized crime initiatives were squashed. And something similar happened with regard to Debut Records. I tell the story also about Atlantic Records, which is still with us, and there hangs a tale. Atlantic Records is started by a man born in Turkey, Ahmet Ertegun, who was the son of a Turkish diplomat, and he grew up in Washington, D.C., a Jim Crow town, but he was fascinated by the music, and so he would organize concerts at the Turkish embassy in Washington, which is technically Turkish soil under international law, and therefore he could thumb his nose at the local Jim Crow regulations and ordinances. And from that, he began to invest in the music, and that led to this juggernaut called Atlantic Records. But even with Ahmet Ertegun, you see the story about how he profited very handsomely, became quite wealthy as a result of this music, and also tell the story about women musicians, a number of whom, of course, have roots in Southern California. I'm thinking of Clora Bryant and Vi Red in particular, and the rather difficult male supremacist barriers that they had to surmount. Women musicians oftentimes tell the story about how men on the bandstand would try to sabotage their performances. Some certain men would not even want to play with them. You had critics who questioned the inherent ability of women musicians to handle certain instruments, particularly the bass and the drum and the saxophone, because it was said, according to these narrow-minded critics, that women did not have the adequate lung capacity. But in any case, that's an essential part of this story, too. And, of course, another part of the story is how so many of these musicians have to go abroad in order to make a living. Randy Weston, the late, great pianist, spent a good deal of his time in Morocco, North Africa. Yusuf Lateef, the horn man, spent a good deal of his time in Nigeria. A number of musicians, as you know, spent time in Paris. Of course, Miles Davis spent a good deal of time in Paris, although he was not permanently exiled, like Art Farmer, who's basically exiled to Vienna, Austria. Horace Parlan, the pianist, like Dexter Gordon of Los Angeles, spent a good deal of his time in Copenhagen, in Denmark. A number of these musicians spent a good deal of time in Japan. In fact, you have musicians, these jazz musicians would make enough money in Japan in 1 month than they could make in a whole year in the United States. In fact, there are more jazz clubs even today in Tokyo than there are in New York City, which is considered to be sort of the hub of this particular industry and particular music. Now, there have been many premature obituaries written for this music. I can't tell you, in terms of doing this research, all the stories I read about how, quote, jazz is dead, unquote. But that's far from accurate. There are thousands of jazz bands as we speak. The music abroad has really caught fire. And I should also say that in terms of future research and future history, that many of these musicians have done a good job of collecting their papers and depositing them in archives. I'm thinking of Charles Mingus, for example, of Los Angeles, whose papers are at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., along with the papers of Max Roach, of Barbadian and Virginian and Brooklyn, Roots, whose papers are at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., Earl Garner, the pianist, his papers are at the University of Pittsburgh. And of course, right there in Los Angeles, you have the Southern California Library for Social Studies and Research on 6120 South Vermont, where I did a lot of my research, which has a very useful and more than adequate collection on the history of this music. And I would point listeners to that particular institution for follow-up.
Beautiful. It goes without saying that I'll be on Amazon securing my copy when it is published on June 18th. Dr. Horn, as always, it is an honor and a privilege rapping with you. Thanks again for coming on and making it plain for our listeners. Please enjoy the rest of your Saturday, kind sir.
You do the same, and good luck to you.
Thank you.